I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. We need a few basic things to live: water, food, emotional support. If just one of those things is missing, it can be tough to lead a productive life. For too many, clean water is hard to come by, but one Kansas City organization is helping meet that need. Today, Water.org CEO Gary White shares how his group is expanding access to this precious resource for folks in developing countries. Then, August's solar eclipse was a big deal. Tourists traveled from around the world to towns like St. Joseph, Missouri, to have a look. So what did locals get out of the extra attention? And what did scientists learn from the sun's disappearing act? We'll find out on Up to Date after this hour's news. They know that access to safe drinkable water is a huge issue in this country and around the globe. What you may not know is that a group based here in Kansas City has already helped more than 7 million people gain access to safe water. That organization, Water.org, has just secured a $50 million social impact investment fund and is now taking dead aim at its goal to end the global water crisis in our lifetimes. Joining me now is Gary White. He's the CEO and co-founder of Water.org. In 2011, Time magazine added his name to its 100 Most Influential People list. Gary, welcome. So nice to have you here.
Thanks, Steve. Good morning.
This new $50 million social impact investment fund, how significant is it? What will this thing enable you guys to do?
Well, this fund is basically saying that we can add a new tool to the toolbox. In addition to raising philanthropic capital donations, we can also go to the market and raise social impact capital, and that's investments. Investors who are willing to take a little bit more risk than they would normally, but to get a huge social return. And in this case, you know, more than 4 million people will get access to water over the course of 7 years using those funds. And if it goes as we think it will, all the investors will be repaid, and they'll also get a financial return in the neighborhood of 3%.
I was going to say, I think I saw 3 or 3.5%. Is that guaranteed or not?
It's not guaranteed because it is an investment fund. It's not a fund that's backed by our balance sheet or anything like that. But, you know, we've been doing this type of work where we're converting this investment capital into microloans for people at the household level in other countries. And as you pointed out, we've reached 7 million people now with those loans. And those loans are repaid, in the mid-90% range. So there's a huge demand for this among the part of the poor living in other countries. And they seem to be very bankable based on our experience.
Ending the global water crisis in our lifetimes. I mean, that's the goal. How realistic is that? And is it my lifetime or is it the lifetime of my kids?
Well, I think it's in my lifetime, I hope, to see this happen. And it is doable. We solved this problem in the U.S. and in Europe, more than 100 years ago. It's not rocket science. We're not looking for, a silver bullet. We know how to do this. So, yes, it can be done. And it's baked into, the U.N. Sustainable Development Goals. And water and sanitation access is a core part of those goals. And it's there because this just robs people of their futures. I mean, can you imagine, waking up every day and not knowing where your water is coming from? Not knowing if you're going to have to collect it from an irrigation ditch that's contaminated, not knowing how far you're going to have to walk, not knowing even if there's a tap in your neighborhood in the slum, is water going to be coming out of that tap today, and how long is it going to take you? So all of these coping costs, we call them, add up to a huge burden on the poor. So it's about $300 billion a year in terms of coping costs, lost time spent walking to collect water, paying for water from these vendors who sell it at very high rates, the health impact. And so with that coping cost we're doing, we're trying to redirect that $300 billion into helping people use their funds to get these small loans and get the water and sanitation solutions they need.
I think I saw on your website that many women and girls spend 6 hours a day collecting water. Why does it take so long? That's almost impossible for me to fathom.
It's because, one, it's seasonal. You don't know how far you might have to walk to get to the nearest stream if you're living in a rural area. And as I mentioned, even in urban areas and slums, there might be a public faucet there, but you don't know when it's going to have water. Sometimes it's only a couple of days a week. Sometimes it's only for a few hours. And so you don't have a predictability in the amount of time that you're going to have to invest in doing that. And that makes you unemployable. You know, if you can't show up at a job consistently, you're not going to be able to take that job. And all of this just adds up to basically arrested economic development on the part of families, not to mention the health implications of poor water, not to mention that girls are spending time collecting water instead of being in school. So, you know, it adds up to more than a million deaths each year. For those 884 million that don't have access to water, nothing else matters at the start of the day until you get water, and it can cost you all kinds of time and money.
So when you guys give your micro loans out, let's say to a typical family overseas, mm-hmm. how much is the loan for, and what is that money used to do?
Mm-hmm. So the typical loan size is about $230, and
wow.
it can be used in urban and peri-urban areas to pay the connection fee to get connected to the public utility, because sometimes that's very unaffordable. Someone might have money to pay a water vendor today, but not the fee. I think one great example, I was just in Lima, Peru a few months ago. I met a woman there who was living in the slums, and she had just taken out a loan for a water connection at her house. It was about $300. And before that, before she had that water faucet in her home, she was walking down the mountainside to this big jug she had. And every day, a big tanker truck would come by and fill that jug with water. She would scoop it out bucket by bucket and carry it back up the hill. She was paying 13 times more per gallon of water from that vendor than she's now paying for water that comes right from her faucet in her home. So you can see the inefficiency of this and these coping costs that people pay. And it's all for want of having a little bit of capital, because she could pay a few, you know, 20, 30 cents a day for that water from the vendor, but she couldn't afford the $300 to connect to the utility.
Are you there sometimes when people get connected for the first time, and I'm wondering how they react? It's got to be a great moment for you.
It is truly amazing. I remember being in I think it was Hyderabad in India, where a woman is turning on her faucet for the first time, and they had candles around the faucet. They had incense burning.
Oh, wow.
They were saying prayers just because this meant so much to them and their family.
How big is the global water crisis today? Describe it to us.
Well, it's about 884 million people that don't have access to water.
884 million yeah. people, which is what yeah. percentage of the planet's population?
It's about between 1/6 and 1/7, I believe,
wow.
right now.
Wow.
So,
wow.
Yeah, so it's a huge amount. And access to sanitation is even worse, right? So it's about 2.2 billion people who don't have access to improved sanitation, basically a toilet.
Yeah. And to what extent are those numbers improving year over year?
So they are improving. You know, when I first got into this work, you know, back in the mid-80s, there were about 2 billion people who lacked access to improved water. And so many people have gained access. In fact, the past two decades, about 2 billion people have gained access to water for the first time. But of course, the population is growing as well. And that's the thing about water and sanitation. As people come out of poverty, one of the first things that they want to do is get a more reliable water supply mm-hmm. to get the dignity and the privacy of a toilet. And so that's what's contributing to this market, which we think is about $12 billion in terms of demand for these micro loans on the part of the poor so that they can get these improvements.
You know, when you guys first began, Gary, my sense was you were acting as a charity, simply mm-hmm. Connecting people to water supplies for free as part of what mm-hmm. you did. But at some point, you made this seismic shift and mm-hmm. you went to this microloan approach. Mm-hmm. Why?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think just a nod to our humble beginnings here in Kansas City back in 1990, we raised $4,300 at the parish where I grew up, St. Bernadette's, at the Knights of Columbus Hall.
Is that right?
And that was the start, right? And it was very much of, there's a problem out there, let's go solve it. And we used the only tool we knew how, you know, we knew of then. And that was like raising charitable dollars and then making making grants and getting projects basically for free for people. And that's important. There are some people who are so poor around the world that they do need that subsidy approach. But what we also discovered over time, you know, meeting women in the slums, and this is the real insight, I think, as we were doing those subsidy-driven projects, people were telling us about how they went to loan sharks and took out loans for 125% interest to build a toilet. And we started understanding how these water vendors worked in the, you know, paying 10 to 15 times more per gallon than if they were connected to the utility. And so it was those insights that led us into water credit in these micro loans. But what's led us from that into water equity is the recognition that even with the amount of capital that's been generated so far, and we've helped generate about $500 million in capital to come in and fund these loans.
It wasn't enough,
right. So we wanted to then match what's happening in the U.S. and Europe with impact investing, where this money from the top down is willing to come in at a lower cost, you know, lower percentage rate generally, if they can have social impact. And that was the birth of water equity and raising this type of social impact capital that provides a financial return at the same time helping millions of people living in poverty get access to services.
And you simply extend the tentacles of water.org in places you never could have imagined when you first began.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And there's a real synergy because water.org is still very much focused on helping, you know, get these market failures corrected and helping more lenders come into the space, like these microfinance institutions. But once they come into the space and they want to scale up, they need that additional capital that water equity is going to generate from a debt perspective.
Gary White's my guest. He's the CEO and co-founder of water.org. In 2011, Time magazine named him to its list of the 100 most influential people on the globe. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Along the way, you met a guy named Matt Damon, who's mm-hmm. become very much part and parcel of what you are working on right now. How did you meet him? Why? Where did his interest come from?
Yeah, so Matt had already started another organization called H2O Africa, which was focused on water in Africa.
Yeah.
And we were introduced, and we basically had a real symmetry between what their organization was doing, raising awareness, raising funds, you know, pointing a lot more people to the issue, and what we were doing, which was very much like getting projects done on the ground. And so there was a real synergy. Matt and I, you know, got to know each other. This was back in 2008, and decided maybe it just made sense to merge the two organizations. So Matt and I brought them together. We rebranded it as water.org, and then he and I became the co-founders of this. And in addition, we, you know, were in the back of a Jeep in India a few years ago when we kind of hatched the idea of water equity, because we were talking to a lot of our partners there as to what was holding them back, and it was this lack of access to debt capital. So Matt's like, I'll put in the first million to this fund and let's get it going. Hmm. And that was the first fund. We raised $11 million with that fund, and that's already out there deployed.
What does that kind of star power, having Matt Damon aboard water.org, what does that enable you to do? What kind of doors does that open for you?
Well, it's a combination. It's basically having Matt and his influence, as well as having a solid organization with a track record. So you put those two together, that opens a lot of doors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were at Davos this past year at the World Economic Forum, and had a lot of great meetings there with potential investors and donors. You know, it helps us get access to more media in terms of painting the picture. Matt and water.org, we've been working with Stella Artois to get the word out more with some of the ad campaigns. And there'll be more of that coming up next year as well. They've become a really great strategic partner for us from a financing perspective.
So is he as cool a guy as I would think he would be just from, I've always thought he's just a terrific actor. Yeah.
Yeah. No, Matt is just, you know, very down to earth, as he
said. I've got to ask you that question,
he said,
of course.
You know, he married a civilian. You know, Lucy, his wife, isn't of Hollywood. And the thing about Matt is he's super smart. I mean, he was a few classes away from graduating from Harvard, you know, when he got his break. And so he has fully immersed himself in this. You know, he talks about having three things in his life. You know, he has his family, and he has four daughters now. Huh. And he has his day job, you know, making films. But this is his third thing, and he'll always reference this. And in fact, he is literally one of the world's water experts now because of how much he's immersed himself in this issue.
Oh, that's great. 816-235-2888 is our number. We're talking with Gary White, CEO of water.org. Let's go to some phone calls and Steve from Lee Summit. Steve, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. I tuned in late, so I don't know whether you touched on this. Isn't it true that a lot of large corporations, very large corporations, i.e. the Koch brothers, I think mainly in South America and Central America, are getting into controlling the water system, and for people that are really impoverished, having to pay exorbitant prices for it. If you talk about that, I'd like one short follow-up, if I could.
Well, Steve, I was going to say you really can't come on the air unless you tell us that you really like Matt Damon's Bourne movies. Okay, you're a big fan, right?
Well, yeah.
We can proceed under those.
Jimmy Kimmel wouldn't keep shutting him off the show.
Go ahead. The influence of large corporations on the international water supply.
Sure, there have been some issues of that in South America. One particular example was in Cochabamba, Bolivia, where there is a need for more financing to come in and improve the infrastructure, and some private financing has been doing that in the past. That's largely receded now because it frankly hasn't been that great of a deal for those companies, those investors, and those firms that are doing it. But the bottom line is there has to be more capital invested in the system. It would take about $200 billion a year over the next 5 years to get the infrastructure where it needs to be and to maintain it. Right now, all of the development assistance and aid combined going in is about $6 billion a year.
Steve?
And my follow-up would be, and it fits right in with this, one thing that really bothers me, because we can't even have a debate on this subject, and Mr. Kratzky never talks about it, no matter what his guests are, and Matt Damon, nobody will talk all around it, human activity, human pollution, human man-made pesticides, human encroachment, and no one will even, we can't even have a discussion about overpopulation. And I see people over and over and over again having, you know, 5, 6, 7 kids, and they're just poverty. You know, look at Philippines and India. I mean, don't you think this should be spoken about or have a discussion on, you know, the need of people to have that many children? Because, you know, it's global warming and everything else, but they just won't even discuss it. What say you?
Well, I think it is important to discuss it, and I think the evidence shows that as people get access to safe water, as they get access to opportunity in education and economic development happens, that's when, you know, fertility rates start to decline. And so I think that the problem contains its own solution, in a sense, in that if we can help get more people lifted out of poverty, then we are going to see, you know, a lower population growth rate and maybe getting to equal or negative population growth.
Okay. Let's go back to some calls. And Janet from Overland Park. Janet, you're on the air.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, thank you, Janet.
Great. Here's my Matt Damon story. I'm from Massachusetts originally, and my uncle was the principal of Matt's middle school.
It's a small world, Janet.
When they were in middle school. So
there you go.
That's my connection there. My question is, my daughters are born in Kenya. We go back every few years. We are looking for ways to make a difference and get involved, and I want to know how the average person can help water.org if we don't have a big checkbook to do that.
I was going to ask you that question. Good question, Janet. Thank you.
So it doesn't have to be a big checkbook. You know, what we can do is you know, use any donations to help more people get access to water and sanitation. And, you know, we do need that. We need help in spreading the word. I mean, there's lots of tools on the water.org website that would allow you and empower you to kind of help go out and spread the word about our work and the solutions. And we've also, on the waterequity.org site, you can come on to that site and make a small loan now. And so we've democratized, you know, it's not just this $50 million fund with million-dollar investors. You know, anyone can come on to the Water Equity site and make a loan.
I'm wondering, just before you go, Gary, you're a kid who graduated from the Missouri University of Science and Technology down in Rolla. How did you get into this water business?
Well, it actually all started at Rolla. I started an organization there that focused on matching engineering students with development projects around the world. And for me, that came out of, you know, my, you know, being brought up here in Kansas City. I went to O'Hara High School, you know, the Christian Brothers High School, and the values that were instilled in me. And just looking for a way to mesh those values with engineering when I was at Rolla. And that's where it all started for me. So really, I haven't done anything else my whole life except for focus on water and sanitation.
We have a tweet here from Sassy, who's wondering, can you speak at all about the water quality in the U.S.? And she's thinking of Flint, Michigan, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the challenge of water safety and in the U.S. is, I think, continuing to grow. And unfortunately, all too often, it's aligned with where there's greater poverty. And I think we see that in Detroit. And it is, you know, we think about water as this looming crisis for the United States and for much of the world. And it is true. It is a looming crisis. And we think about the environment as a looming crisis. But really, today, you know, access to water, water contamination, sewerage is the greatest environmental disaster that's happening to the planet. You know, you talk to, you know, the couple of billion people who don't have water or sanitation. It's a crisis today, and, you know, losing a million people a year. So it you know, they both need to be addressed domestically as well as internationally. It's just that as water.org, we've tried to maintain some humility and saying we're not going to solve it everywhere. We're going to have some expertise in kind of the emerging markets, developing countries, and we're going to go all in there. But certainly applaud all the efforts to you know, increase our water security in the U.S. and around the world.
That's Gary White, CEO and co-founder of water.org. Gary, what a great conversation. Thanks for coming in, and keep up the good work, okay?
Great. Thanks, Steve.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to look back at that big eclipse back in August and how it changed our lives, or did it. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's program, we found out how to have conversations that matter in an era of deep polarization. And we discussed redeveloping distressed neighborhoods and avoiding gentrification. You can find those conversations at kcur.org and on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, meet a University of Kansas social worker who researches growing up in different and small towns. And Senator Claire McCaskill talks about her reelection campaign in Missouri and what's going on out in Washington. Well, that big lunar eclipse back in August wound up being shrouded in clouds for many of us, but for others, not so much. Was it the big life-altering moment that a lot of people had anticipated? Well, I'll just raise my hand and say it was very, very cool, but in Parkville, where I was broadcasting that day, the clouds moved in just a few minutes before totality. I'm not sure I left the experience a different person. Now, an update on the impact of this once-in-a-lifetime event. With us, Angela Speck is a professor of astrophysics and director of astronomy at the University of Missouri-Columbia. She's also co-chair of the National Total Solar Eclipse Task Force, and she visited with us a few weeks before the eclipse. Dr. Speck joins us from the studios of KBIA in Columbia. Angela, good morning.
Good morning.
Beth Carmichael's here in the studio with me. She's a project development director with the St. Joseph Visitors Bureau. Beth, nice to have you too.
Thanks for having me.
Well, was this the big the event that you expected it to be, Angela? What's your take on that?
So, like you say, the cloud really made a difference. I think across Missouri, we had patchy cloud, and even on very short scale. So for some people, it was, yes, absolutely life-changing, amazing. And for some people, it was really disappointing.
Beth, how about you?
Well, I was one of nine people in my office and the only one that got to see the eclipse.
I read that. You were the lucky one.
I was the lucky one.
You drew the short straw. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. I was at Rosecrans Airport where we saw about 20 to 25,000 people. And I got to see about 10 to 20 seconds. I was thrilled because we had worked really daily for 2 years on the eclipse. So I was really excited, but disappointed for the rest of our staff. I think that our experience and what we heard from our visitors in St. Joseph was that even if they didn't get to see the eclipse, it was an opportunity for them to spend time with friends and family. And they were just excited to be there. Mm-hmm. It was a really exciting, interesting event that we've never experienced before. And a lot of our visitors, especially at Rosecrans, said, I'm just happy to be spending time with friends and family. Yes, we didn't get to see it. Yes, we're disappointed, but we are really excited to be here and be part of this.
Yeah, we know where Beth was now, Angela, but during the eclipse, but where did the co-chair of the National Total Solar Eclipse Task Force hang out during such a rare event?
So I was actually in downtown Columbia.
Really?
And I had a great view. There was some patchy cloud, but it cleared up, and we were actually at a rooftop bar, because where else would you watch an eclipse? Mm-hmm. And we had a really great view, being able to see all 360 degrees of sunset colors, and yeah, it was pretty amazing.
Given how many months you spent educating the public about this eclipse, as the hour approached, how excited were you?
You know, I got to a point where I'd been so excited for so long that it was just almost numb. and then when it happened, it was like, I was actually broadcasting live on TV, so I was not able to curse in the way that I might have otherwise.
Yeah. Angela, do we know how many people watch this thing?
So we've got some studies that have been done that suggest that, you know, if you include people who watched it online, so people who didn't make it to the path themselves, between people who saw it directly and electronically, it was 200 million people. It was 80 to 90% of the adult population.
That's like Super Bowl territory, isn't it?
It's big. Super Bowl is more like, in recent years, it's been more like 60 million.
Wow.
To put it in perspective, the moon landing, although worldwide it had 600 million viewers, in the U.S. only, it was 125 million. So we beat the moon landing.
I'm wondering from our listener standpoint, if this was the life-altering experience they had hoped for heading into this eclipse, give us a call. 816-235-2888 is our number, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Beth, how long did you guys spend planning this thing up there in St. Joseph?
The very first time we even heard that we were on the path of totality was about 4.5 years ago, when somebody in all caps emailed one of our staff and said, "Do you know you're on the path of totality?" And we were all like, "What's totality? What's an eclipse? What, you know?" We kind of knew what an eclipse was, but we really had to figure out what that was.
Did you sense then that it was going to be a big deal?
No.
No, okay.
No, we didn't.
Just some deal.
We just did some research. We started talking to eclipse experts and found out that it was going to be a big deal. Eclipse experts had told us early on to expect anywhere between 50 and 500,000 people. And so when we started
That's a range for you.
It was a huge range, and it was a huge range from a planning perspective. So once we started hearing those numbers, we thought we better start doing something. And we were continuing to receive a lot of emails and calls asking what we were doing. And as those calls started to come in, we kind of stood up and took notice and said, we've probably got to do something here.
You know, what was going on in Kansas City? Because it seems like, at least among the people I talked to, people in my neighborhood, going north to St. Joe seemed to be the path that people were taking. You could have gone west and a little north. You could have gone east and caught it, you know, further down like I-70. But people were going north. At least that's what they were talking about ahead of time, in droves. Why? Why St. Joe?
Well, St. Joseph was the fifth largest city on the path of totality.
Okay.
And Angela will share with you the reason why Missouri was so important. But because we had all of this infrastructure, we had roads, restaurants, hotels, all that sort of stuff. And from a Kansas City market, everybody looks at us and says, you know, we're just an hour away. So if they decided to go to, say, Columbia or someplace like that, that's a further drive. It's mm-hmm. a quick, easy drive. What even that week of, people were like, yeah, I'm going to get up at 9 and I'll get on the road at 10. And so one of our challenges was to let people in the Kansas City market know specifically that they needed to leave earlier in the morning. And our experience was a lot of people listened. I was at Rosecrans at 4 in the morning, and we had a line of cars already coming in. So our traffic issues that everybody was like, well, there wasn't really that much traffic. Coming in, people were really listening, getting there early, settling in, enjoying themselves. And on the way out, as totality had finished, even beforehand, people were leaving because they didn't feel like we were going to have totality. So they thought, oh, let me run and get out in front of the traffic. So the traffic was backed up. Even down here in Kansas City, I heard that 635 was backed up after totality had been completed.
How quickly did the hotel rooms fill up?
You know what? We still had availability started, you know, even in June and the beginning of July. The problem was, for some people, they weren't prepared to pay the prices that our hotels were asking.
Oh, and what prices were they asking?
They were asking upwards of $300 and $400 a night.
No kidding.
Yeah.
It was bonanza time for
a lot
of folks. Eh? Let's go to some phone calls here as we look back at the great American eclipse from August. Gavin from Overland Park, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. I didn't have to stay overnight any place. I just got up early in the morning and fought traffic to go right in the path of totality, and I'm still bitterly angry. I hate hearing mentions of the eclipse because I feel like I missed a life-changing event. Meanwhile, my wife, who was not all that excited but works downtown and her building is in the path of totality, went, and she said, oh, yeah, I saw it. It was fine.
Oh, Gavin, I'm sorry. Angela, do you want to offer any condolences to Gavin?
Well, so there is actually only 7 years till the next U.S. eclipse. And if you want to spend money, you can go to Chile in 2019. But the next one is on the east side of the state. So, you know, it's a few hours drive, but you would be able to go and see one in April of 2024, and it runs up the east edge of Missouri. So
I'm ashamed to say this, but I already have it on my calendar.
Excellent.
Well, there's a reason to live, Gavin. Thanks for the phone call.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Paul from Kansas City. Paul, you're on Up Today as we look back at the great eclipse. Good morning.
Yeah, I feel sorry for Gavin. I have a friend and came in from Dresden, Germany to see this. We live in the totality area in Platte City. Our primary was go to St. Joe, but I started watching National Weather Service. I started looking at things a week ahead of time. They started getting good predictions. We ended up deciding to go to Ravenna, Nebraska, just outside of Grand Island. It was nice and bright and sunny. We saw everything. And somebody from the St. Joe group that didn't come asked me how things were, and I tweeted or rather messaged back a picture of a bright blue sky, and they said it was pouring rain.
Oh.
But we had a really good experience, and they were right on right in maximum totality. That town, it was excellent.
Paul, thanks for the good call. How disappointing was it, Beth, to have the rain in that day? That must have been at least a little bit disappointing.
It was devastating. And it was devastating. I think Gavin's comment is not uncommon, and we've heard that frequently, that, you know, a lot of people had made it up to St. Joe to just have that experience. What happened if you were inside of St. Joseph, you weren't able to see it, but because at Rosecrans it's flat and it was a drop zone, it is the drop zone for our National Air National Guard, you could see that 360-degree sunset. So you did get some of that experience.
Right.
And from my perspective, you got to see things that you probably wouldn't have paid attention to for that 2 minutes and 38 seconds if you would have gotten totality.
Yeah.
So we saw birds, we saw bats, we saw some animals, nocturnal animals coming out. And I think that if you had that 2 minutes and 38 seconds, you would have been paying attention to the sun and not really looking around. But because we didn't have that, we were able to see that 360 sunset.
But that's putting a good spin on a bad situation. I appreciate that. Leslie from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Good morning. So not to pile on to the media, as we hear about a lot today, but the hype from the media was this was a once-in-a-lifetime event. And once I heard that this actually happens every couple of years in the world and that we'll probably see it in the U.S. somewhere in, 7 years, I guess my excitement kind of faded a bit. I thought it was cool to see it. I was able to see it, and I'm glad I did. But I was not nearly as thrilled as everyone else I talked to. So I don't want to be a cold, you know, person or whatever. But it just didn't thrill me like it did everyone else, I guess.
All right, Leslie. Was it overhyped, Angela?
No. sorry.
That's good.
You know, it is true that we get, you know, it's not quite every year, but almost every year we get an eclipse somewhere on the planet. But it's only, you know, 0.1% of the surface of the Earth that gets to see it. And most of the surface of the Earth is water. So even though on a planetary scale, they are relatively common, they're very rare. This was the first one in Missouri in 150 years. And yes, there is another one coming up in 7 years. But some people won't be around for that. Some people won't make it. It might be clouded out in the place that you go to. This might be your only chance to see it. So, you know, I don't think it was overhyped at all. I think that most of the people I spoke to were utterly thrilled, even people who'd been kind of naysayers. I got a lot of texts and tweets that were along the lines of, that was amazing, thanks for sharing. And, you know, these were people who hadn't been that excited about it. So I think that the last caller was more of an anomaly. You know, there are always going to be some people who just don't feel the emotion that most of us got from that. She needs to find something else that makes her happy.
Why emotion, though, Angela? Why is emotion part of something like this when it's a scientific freaky kind of thing that comes along once in a while? Why so emotional for some people?
Well, so it's something that's unlike anything you've ever experienced,
sure.
Right? But even people who've seen them before tend to have that emotional reaction. But I'm not sure how to answer that because it's like art or music or something like, you know, there are some things that most people will react to emotionally. And, you know, it's like people who cry at the end of a movie that's really sad and,
right.
You know, I'm not sure that you can define exactly what it is.
I can appreciate that, yeah.
Well, and I think, too, the other thing is it's a natural phenomenon. I think in today's society, there's so many things that are built up if you're thinking about Disney World and that experience. This is just happening in nature, and sometimes I think people aren't really interested in or don't really – we have so many things that are happening to us today that, you know, you don't really sit back and think – that doesn't happen very often.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That 1%, you know, 1% of the world just got that, was on that path of totality.
That's the, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about the great solar eclipse. That was the voice of Beth Carmichael. She's Project Development Director at the St. Joseph Visitors Bureau. We're also joined by Angela Speck, a professor of astrophysics over at Mizzou. We have an email here from Gabby, and she writes, "We watched the eclipse from lawn chairs in our driveway in Independence. It was even cooler than I thought. My wife was underwhelmed until the moment of totality, and then she agreed it was pretty freaking awesome." Let's go to Margaret here from Lenexa. Margaret, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
It was disappointing to go up to St. Joe and plan the trip to miss the actual totality event itself because of the cloud cover.
Right.
But the 360 was absolutely gorgeous, and the kids were so excited for it that it didn't matter to them that they missed that little bit. And I just wanted to say my hat is off to the city of St. Joseph for the information packets that they sent out to everybody that was traveling in from all different locations. I got the 22-page information packet that had locations of hospitals, drugstores, emergency services, anything you could possibly want to know for anybody coming in from out of town. And, you know, we went camping for the weekend, and yeah, we got a little wet, but it was fantastic. And the kids are looking forward to hopefully taking a trip down to Little Rock in 2024 and doing it again.
Oh, that's great. Well,
thank you,
Margaret. Congratulations, Beth.
Thank you. Yeah. I appreciate that.
You know, Angela Speck, you guys did some experiments at Mizzou on animals and plants. And how did animals and plants behave during the eclipse? What was your takeaway?
So, you know, some of of it's still preliminary in terms of putting data together, but we certainly saw some interesting effects on plants. So one of the things that we were looking at is, do plants really react to the change in brightness, or do they have a circadian rhythm? So is it really on a like a timer? And there's already some preliminary videos out online that you can see that show that, you know, different types of plants close up. So there were some clovers that are definitely circadian. They didn't really react to the change in light or temperature. Whereas there were other plants, like there were soybeans and some others that as it got darker, some of them curled up. Some of them uncurled, depending on what their reactions at night are. So that was kind of cool. And Beth kind of mentioned the issue of nocturnal beasties. One of the things that, again, it's not, you know, this is kind of at the very preliminary stage, but cicadas started tweeting, chirping. Yes, and that was one of the things that we didn't know if it would happen or not, because cicadas do this thing where they wait until after the birds have gone to roost, but before the bats come up. And that's when they do their mating chirp, because that's when it's safe, right? Mm. And we weren't sure, because it goes from kind of early twilight to dark very fast. And the level of darkness you get depends on so many different things that we weren't sure if the cicadas would make any noise. So it's kind of interesting that, you know, we've got sound detectors in different places, and you actually get different levels of darkness. So that's one of the things that we're still digging into. But there was a lot going on, and all of these beasties and plants all doing their thing. And I think, like Beth said, that was something cool that a lot of people missed, because just looking at the sun was really amazing.
Well, what about your NASA-funded projects about how the shadow affected atmospheric properties like, you know, temperature and air pressure and that kind of thing, Angela?
Right. So we actually had stations set up so that we were investigating different environments. So we had one in a soybean field, one on a prairie, and one in a forest environment. And you can see differences in the amount of temperature drop. Now, it's possible that the soybean field, because of where it was, there might be some interference from a cold front that was, there was a cold airflow coming in that might be a problem. But you can clearly see that they all have a drop in temperature, but it changes slightly. And we're also measuring basically the ground temperature versus higher up in the atmosphere. And you can also see that both of them drop in temperature, but how much they drop depends on which environment you're in. So though, again, this is all preliminary results. There's a lot of data to push through, but we really did get a good feel for how the different environments are affected by that change in light.
And also there was the Columbia campus taking part in the CATE project. Remind our listeners what that is, Angela.
So Citizen CATE, which is spelled C-A-T-E, mm-hmm. Was a project where there were 68 identical setups of telescopes with instruments all along the path of totality. There were about five across Missouri. So there was one up in Excelsior Springs. There was one in Columbia. There was one in Herman and so on. They've started to put together that data. So basically they were taking images of the corona once the sun has eclipsed every 5 seconds. And we have that for the entire path. And it looks like even though there was some cloud, you know, at places along the path, it looks like we've got data that's almost continuous all the way across that. And you can clearly already see things like prominences. So there are these little short videos, and you can see prominences coming off the sun. And you can see that there are places where we're seeing jets that are moving fairly slowly. So like gas currents coming off the sun in the corona that suggests something about what the magnetic field is doing. So it's all very preliminary, but there are some, and if you Google it, you can find some cool videos of preliminary data on what's going on. But that was to study how the corona behaves. We're already getting results out of that.
Let's go back to some phone calls here as we talk about the great eclipse. Bob from North Kansas City, who shared the experience with a 7-year-old. Hi, Bob.
Hey, good morning.
Hi.
I just wanted to talk about, how my 7-year-old and I were really lucky. We live in the path of totality. We were able to sit there in our driveway, and even though there were some clouds, we were able to see the corona through the really thin clouds, and, it just made a huge impact on me, and I really hope it made a huge impact on him, because sitting there and holding his hand, watching this solar eclipse is going to be, you know, a memory I take with me for the rest of my life, and I really hope he has the same experience.
How did he react to it?
Oh, he was just mystified. He thought it was great. And to talk about earlier, she mentioned the cicadas chirping. He noticed that and brought it to my attention. He said, "Hey, listen to the crickets, Dad." And it was just great.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Bob, thanks for the good call. I appreciate it.
And I think it's funny he's saying that, because one of the things that we heard from visitors as they were coming up is they remember spending or sharing an eclipse with their grandparents or their aunts or their uncles or their parents, and they were bringing their younger relatives with them so that they could have a similar experience. But these were some people in their 80s and 90s that were willing to share that experience as well.
That's amazing. Jackie from Overland Park, welcome to Up to Date.
Hello, Angela and Beth. This is Jackie, your eclipse chaser from Kansas City.
Hi, Jackie.
You guys know her.
Yes, all of us worked our little hearts out getting everybody to come and see the eclipse someplace, right, gal?
That's right.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yes, we did. And I don't know about you two, but I've been hearing back from a lot of people that would just thank me up and down for making them go see it or urging them to go see it, because they so much were just overjoyed with watching it.
Oh,
and Jackie was working with the BBC worldwide.
Ah.
So they needed somebody to commentate for them in St. Joseph. So we hooked Jackie up with the BBC. And so she was on BBC Worldwide talking about the eclipse. Yep.
Good for you, Jackie. Thanks for the call.
It was a lot of fun.
All right. Appreciate it. Beth, I'm wondering if you've been able to calculate how much visitors spent over the course of the eclipse weekend and what kind of boost St. Joseph received.
We don't have that information yet. We may have that in cooperation with the Missouri Division of Tourism. They're doing their annual economic impact study for tourism across the state, and they're going to be adding some eclipse questions in with that. So we're hoping to have that within the next 3 or 4 months.
Angela, how long will the data from this eclipse be studied in the years to come?
Well, so when it comes to scientific data like this, it's something that you can go back to. So there'll be initial papers that come out that show, you know, oh, this is really cool stuff we've discovered. But then as we get new data, so the next eclipse and the next eclipse, you want to compare. You know, the magnetic field of the sun is changing all the time. So the data we have on the corona from this one needs to be compared to the next one and the next one and the next one. So it has actually quite a lot of longevity. And the same with, like, the atmospheric effects. You know, we can't simulate the effects we get from an eclipse in the lab. It's just not possible. So in terms of understanding the atmosphere, and with the issues like climate change, understanding how the atmosphere reacts to changes is really important. So I think this will have a lot of life going forward.
Is there a common place where results from the various experiments that were conducted on eclipse day are being compiled in place so that people can go look at all this?
So right now, that, you know, we're a little too early for that. I think going forward, that's the sort of thing that we will do. But we're certainly looking at presenting preliminary data and also some of the lessons learned on planning at some of our big professional conferences. And that then provides us venues to post things through online sites. That we already built a website through the American Astronomical Society to serve the entire nation. And that's already been switched over so that it's ready for the next eclipse. But we will be sharing what we learned, both scientifically and just from a planning point of view, through that website.
Well, let's go out with this. Daniel just wrote us this. Absolutely spiritual, he said. We watched in Boonville, Missouri, as homeschooled parents. This was our best field trip to date. To see the hummingbirds come out in droves around our bird feeder was so awesome. A day my kids and I will remember forever. That's a way to end this thing. Beth Carmichael, thanks so much for coming down from the St. Joseph Visitors Bureau. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Angela Speck, a professor of astrophysics over at the University of Missouri Columbia. Angela, sure appreciate your time as well.
Thank you.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. On tomorrow's show, a University of Kansas researcher and a member of the LGBTQ community on growing up different in small town America. We'll also catch up with Senator Claire McCaskill. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Justin Garnett produced this show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.